You're there?
You may proceed.
Sorry, Your Honor. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm ready.
Okay, we are too.
I'll have to say, obviously, I take this matter very personally, and am not happy that the district court would award sanctions for me in this case, against me in this case. Section 1927 was designed to sanction attorneys who willfully abuse the process by engaging in conduct that amounts to bad faith. A bad faith determination is only appropriate when an attorney frivolously claims frivolously engages in arguments that are not valid or obstructs non-frivolous claims. Neither of those are present in the case of this particular matter. The two matters that the court was concerned with were motions related to possession of the property after the foreclosure and a motion related to return of the funds. Those are the primary ones that are at issue. As we know, California law would apply in both of those cases. So what does California law say with regard to possession of the property after foreclosure, and what does it say with regard to the bidding process? In both of those cases, my arguments were not frivolous. In the case of post-foreclosure possession...
Could someone mute the phone?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I have a dog barking. I can't stop it. I tried.
Oh, it's your dog.
My dog. I apologize. I've tried. In the case of the motions, they brought two motions. One, they sought effectively to obtain possession, or they at least argued in their motions that they could get possession while the redemption period was going. The second thing is they sought the court to set rents while the redemption period was going. In both of those cases, the motions were opposed because it seemed that they were arguing to this court or the district court that they could get rents during the redemption period. That's simply not the law. Now, as far as the right to possession, California law is clear. During the redemption period, the homeowner has an absolute right to possess the property. That's not subject to paying rents. There is no law that says they can't have possession.
You didn't cite California procedure section 729.090 in your brief, did you?
I did not, Your Honors, and I'm assuming the court is referring to the provision that says that rents are recoverable.
That's right.
It's a question of when they're recoverable, and they're not recoverable until after the redemption period expires.
The statute says from the time of the sale until a redemption.
I agree.
The purchaser is entitled to receive from the person in possession the rents and profits for the property or the value of the use and occupation of the property. So how do you read from the time of the sale until a redemption?
No, they are, Your Honor. But the problem with that is that you have to read the case law. And the case law says that the homeowner can redeem the property. And in that event, they are not entitled to any rents from the homeowner. The case law also says over and over and over again that the homeowner is entitled to absolute possession of the property during the redemption period. Not conditioned at all on the payment of rents. What that statute is meant to say and what it does say is that if rents are received from a third party, then the foreclosing party is entitled to recover those rents, but not charge rent to the homeowner.
How do you read the phrase to receive from the person in possession?
In
possession, right?
I would agree, Your Honor. Your Honor, what I'm saying is
federal media, that statute, that they are obligated to pay use and occupancy during the period of time between the sale and redemption?
That's correct, Your Honor. They're not obligated to pay any rents during that time, and we can't determine if they will.
Notwithstanding what the statute says.
Notwithstanding what the statute says. And the reason, again...
How is it that you didn't cite that statute in your brief?
I don't think it's relevant to the issues in this case, Your Honor.
If I look at what I think the trial court was unhappy about, it seems to be one is the delay in turning over the insurance policy. That was one. And the second was a claim that you stonewalled on the meet and confer. Could you address those issues, please?
I would, Your Honor. With regard to the insurance policy, there's no evidence that I had anything to do with that. In fact, I didn't refuse to meet and confer on that. I did meet and confer on that. And in fact, I did not have the insurance policy. In fact, as soon as the order came out from the court, I made sure that my clients produced it. I will note that as the court made abundantly clear in its opinions in this case, the Parabias are not cooperative parties. I can't control what my client does. All I can do is do what I can do in terms of what they give me. If they don't give me the insurance policy, I can't produce it. And that's exactly what occurred in regard to the insurance policy. And if the court will remind me on the second issue.
Well, that
stay
was
with,
the...
Let's stay with that issue. I'm looking at your declaration dated November 21, 2019. On receipt of the order, you write, I instructed the Parabias to comply with all of its terms. I understood... And this is where this phrase troubles me. I understood that they had met with the receiver and provided a copy of the insurance they had on the property. Now, as a trial attorney, you know that a statement like that is not competent evidence. So what does it hide?
It's not hiding anything, Your Honor. I understood that they had provided the policy of insurance. Of course, the court needs to take note that I can't convey discussions I had with my clients, particularly at that time. I cannot breach the attorney-client privilege.
But if you're blaming your clients for not doing what the court order says they should be doing, you're not operating in privilege anymore. Either you accept responsibility, or you blame it on your clients. And if you blame it on your clients, you're in a different phrase. And the code of responsibility allows you to do that.
Well, the court is reading intention into my statement. My statement is I understood that the policy had been provided by the Parabias. I could have said my understanding was based on conversations with my client. I see that as violating the attorney-client privilege.
But why don't you have one of their declarations?
I didn't see it as necessary, Your Honor.
Because you felt that your sentence, I understood, would cover the point.
That's correct.
And then your engagement in two trials in Miami and Boston acquits you from finding out what you have to do in your own office.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. However, in today's modern world, sending someone an email and expecting an immediate response is not right, reasonable either. People are engaged in other matters. One day is not an unreasonable time, period.
And Judge McEwen asked you about meet and confer.
Yes, Your Honor. I did meet and confer. I did not ignore them at all. I got them the policy as soon as I could. As soon as the ex parte came out, I obtained the policy and I got it over to them. Since the court is concentrating on those issues, I'm going to note that the order in this case, they certainly was not $19,000 in fees related to that one ex parte obtaining the insurance policy. So if the court is going to concentrate on that, then I'm going to say the fees in relation to that are extremely small, under $2,000, yet we have a $19,000 reward in this case. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to point out, Your Honors, that in this case, my conduct was not frivolous. It was not in bad faith. I did nothing to multiply the proceedings in this case. And all of my arguments are supported by California law. I'll reserve 5 minutes for my reply.
All right.
Thank you.
morning, Your Honors. Mr. Lopez spent most of his argument talking about whether the arguments that he made in the district court were, whether or not they were frivolous. What Mr. Lopez did not address is a very important part of the standard for imposing sanctions under Section 1927, and that is that even a non-frivolous argument can be sanctionable if it's made for the purpose of harassing an opponent. And in this case, Your Honors, the evidence is overwhelming that Mr. Lopez's clients had engaged in a years-long effort to delay and harass the plaintiff, State Bank of Texas. Mr. Lopez wants to blame his clients for the sanction, but what Judge Lorenz did was sanction Mr. Lopez for his own actions following a long pattern of sanctionable conduct by his clients.
Well, you know, I read their record. I went back and went through the whole district court docket. And it seems obvious why Judge Lorenz was upset and peeved. And Mr. Lopez's clients may not be angelic examples of the perfect client. But it seems some of that rubbed off on the judge's view of Mr. Lopez, because there was such a long period before of delay, harassment, difficult clients, etc. So I assume you don't suggest that that should be tagged to Mr. Lopez, what happened before.
No, Your Honor. However, because the court had to make a finding of subjective bad faith, nobody but Mr. Lopez knows for sure what was going through his mind. But it was appropriate for Judge Lorenz to look at the prior history of the case in order to draw inferences about the subjective state of mind of Mr. Lopez. And so Mr. Lopez may have been taking orders from his clients, but that's not an excuse under Section 1927. Otherwise, any lawyer could say, hey, I just did what my clients asked me to do.
Mr. Hilton, what's your position with regard to the first motion that Mr. Lopez made after coming into the case? The motion he made on October 4 to set aside the foreclosure and to seek a TRO against foreclosure. Was that a proper motion?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor, but I don't think that's one of the motions for which we're seeking sanctions, because it was only in response to that motion that Mr. Lopez knew for sure what two federal courts had found with respect to his client's conduct.
Well, Mr. Lopez can be charged with knowing how the Paravias used bankruptcy as a means of trying to avoid foreclosure. So it was not the first effort to stop foreclosure.
I believe that Mr. Lopez had an ethical obligation before he ever filed anything in the case to investigate what had happened and to familiarize himself with the history of the case. But whether or not I'm right on that, when he filed that first motion in response, State Bank of Texas informed him and the district court about what the bankruptcy court had found, which is that the Paravias, through two separate bankruptcy filings, both filed either the day before or the morning of scheduled foreclosure actions, had engaged in a scheme to hinder, delay, and defraud State Bank of Texas. And then the court, the district court, Judge Lorenz, in ruling on that first motion, noted in his order that the Paravias had engaged in a pattern of frivolous and fraudulent filings. So by that time, at the earliest, Mr. Lopez was aware that there was a long history of harassment and delay. And from that point forward,
that shouldn't be charged to him, so to speak, correct? correct? I mean, as I said before, there's a long history in this case that would send any judge, you know, into a tailspin. But that was before Mr. Lopez arrives on the scene.
But Mr. Lopez, we believe and we think that the law requires, as in acting ethically as an attorney, has a responsibility. He can't simply ignore the history of the case. If his clients are asking him to file something, and then this is really the important part of Section 1927, whether an individual filing is frivolous or not, it can be sanctionable if it's done with the intent to harass. And you can't, Mr. Lopez was obligated to familiarize himself with his client's conduct in order for him to know whether his client's motivation was to harass the plaintiff.
But, counsel, if I could just jump in here, I guess one of my concerns about Judge Lorenz's order is that, to me, it's not precise enough. And here's what I mean by that, is that there's stuff that happened before Mr. Lopez got on the case, and Mr. Lopez is then filing oppositions to motions that you're on behalf, that you filed on behalf of your client. If you file an opposition to a motion, is that multiplying the proceedings under Section 1927?
It can be if the motion is an issue that has already, if your response to the motion is to do nothing but raise an issue that the district court has repeatedly heard and rejected, then the answer to that question is yes. And that is what Judge Lorenz found in this case, is that Mr. Lopez, on at least three occasions, re-argued his point about the necessity for a separate unlawful detainer action. He did that at least three times after Judge Lorenz rejected that argument.
What were the three times?
Let me find it, Your Honor. Excuse me.
You say the October 4, 2019 was not one of those times. And the next one is Lopez's opposition to the order granting to the bank a CRO, appointing a receiver and ordering the Paravias to pay rent. Lopez opposed that. Was that opposition filed by Lopez an instance of tending to hear in intent to hinder creditors?
We believe it was.
I suppose he really believed that an unlawful detainer was required as a precondition to that, and that there was no unlawful detainer. Whether it hinders creditors or not, if it's a legitimate argument, he can make it, can't he?
He can make it, Your Honor. First of all, I believe that this court actually has already resolved that issue did come up on a separate appeal to this court, and the court rejected it. However, even setting that aside, what Mr. Lopez says in his reply brief is that he raised that issue repeatedly because he felt that he needed to preserve his right to appeal. But the flaw with that argument is that if the primary or sole reason for raising that issue in subsequent papers is to re-argue that issue only, then he shouldn't be filing the motion.
So that's the first instance that you're talking about. And then the second instance is the insurance policy. And what's the third instance?
There was one other that we haven't talked about, Your Honors, and that is the issue where Judge Lorenz found that Mr. Lopez instructed his client, Dr. Paravia, not to comply with the order to pay rent. That was presented to Judge Lorenz by the testimony of the receiver, who testified that he attempted to collect rent from Dr. Parabia. Dr. Parabia told him that she had been instructed by Mr. Lopez that she was not required to pay rent. And Mr. Lopez filed a declaration in response where he does not even attempt to refute that testimony. So that's an issue that we haven't talked about in this hearing, but we think it's very important because it's uncontroverted. And
Do we know that he told the client that? I know there were still two or three lawyers of record at this point. We know what lawyer. Do we have specific evidence? All we have is, I think, the receiver's affidavit of what we have. The receiver's affidavit of what the client said, I don't know the timing of that. The rent order didn't have an amount till January, so there seems to be some confusion about that. Maybe you can help us out.
Your Honor, the receiver wasn't appointed until after Mr. Lopez took over the case, so it had to have been after Mr. Lopez was counsel of record.
Was the court's order fixing the amount of the sanction tied to the instance of violations of Section 1927? Or was it a general statement?
Yes, Your Honors. The district court made three specific findings about conduct that was sanctionable. One was the issue of the repeated efforts to obtain the insurance. The second was briefing related to the Parabia's arguments on the rent order, the appropriate rent amount, and efforts to obtain the payment of rent and for the motion for the writ of execution. The court also found that the forcing the bank to respond to the Parabia's opposition to the bank's motion for distribution of proceeds is sanctionable, and that Mr. Lopez's conduct in refusing to cooperate with informal efforts to obtain possession of the property, which led to the filing and required the filing of a motion for writ of possession, and Mr. Lopez's opposition and forcing the bank to file an opposition to the motion to quash were sanctionable, and the court based the sanctions amount on those particular events. So, Your Honors, I'm short on time. I'll just ask the court if they have any additional questions, and I'd be happy to attempt to address them.
Here's not. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, I'm going to point out that no amount of rent was ordered to be paid until January, as the court properly pointed out. And there's no evidence I ever instructed my clients to not pay rent. I wouldn't have done that because they were never ordered to pay rent. The amount of rent wasn't set until January, and that's when the eviction took place also. So there was never an occasion for me to tell them not to pay rent to the receiver, because simply put, I wouldn't know what amount of rent they would have to pay. Had they received rents from a third party, they were instructed that those rents would have to be paid from the receiver, but I have no information that they in fact ever did receive rents. But I never told the Parabias not to pay rents. And I think that the court has hit directly on another point in this case, that the judge's order awarding sanctions appears to charge to me motions that they brought that I had nothing to do with. I did not make them file a motion to obtain rents. That was their choice to do so. The Parabias were under no order to pay rents at that time. I did not make them move for a receiver. I did not make them bring a motion asking for the amount that they bid at the sale at any time. And it is my obligation to fully and adequately represent my clients and ask the court to follow the law as justified by the case law and the statutes. And that's exactly what I did here. I filed very short oppositions to each of their motions, pointing out very short issues regarding the proposed order or ruling. One, I still believe a post-foreclosure unlawful detainer is necessary. Two, I believe that the court's order distributing the funds is a direct violation of California law on that issue. And three, I think that you do need a judgment for possession to get a writ of possession. I still believe that. I haven't changed my mind on that. I understand this court in this case has ruled otherwise, but I think that a California court would not agree with that. Simply put, Your Honor, I think that what occurred here is that Judge Lorenz is mad at the Parabias. And I've been involved in many of these cases, and I would agree. Homeowners make frivolous arguments. They delay foreclosures. They all do it. And the judges don't like these cases. But that does not justify awarding sanctions against me for raising reasonable arguments before the court to represent my client. I didn't move to set this sale aside.
Let me ask Mr. Lopez, when you made your first motion in October of 2019, you should have been aware of everything that happened before. You explain in your declarations that the former attorney was not cooperative in giving you the records, but there was the ECF. The court's docket showed everything. You would have known that there had previously been an order to foreclose. You would have known about the frivolous bankruptcy proceedings. You would have known about the frivolous lawsuit in the Superior Court of San Diego. And nevertheless, you made the motion. So is it fair to blame the Parabias when a lawyer tells them what the Parabias could do?
Your Honor, I will note again, that motion was not at issue in regards to this sanction order at any point in time.
Yes, but it sets the framework, because you kept on doing the same thing.
Well, I didn't keep doing the same thing. I raised that argument because the Parabias presented me with evidence that after all of this had happened, they entered into a settlement with State Bank of Texas. That's the only reason I brought the motion. I wasn't concerned with their prior conduct because I didn't feel that motion was frivolous. I had a notarized document indicating that, in fact, they had settled, and therefore the default judgment was improper. That's why the motion was brought. Of course, I'm wary of what my client has done, and I'm fully aware of what my clients have done. But in this case, that didn't guide me in any way. I wasn't trying to hinder or delay anything. I was simply asking the court to follow the law.
No further questions. Thank you for the argument. Thank both of you for the argument this morning. The case just argued of State Bank of Texas versus Lopez is submitted, and we're adjourned for the morning.
Thank you.
All rise.